It's July 1st, 2010. This is Candace Ellis with
Amanda Knoll
interviewing families from the Panama Canal Zone. If you guys want to introduce yourself, we'll be interviewing
Bonnie Davis Dolan,
Karen Dolan Bapp,
and Edward Dolan.
Today, on July 1st, 2010. All right, so you had started telling us that you both were in the Canal Zone, and this is your daughter.
Right.
So if you want to maybe start with that story, how you guys came to be there.
Well, our story there begins with Bonnie's family, mm-hmm. who came down for the construction of the canal. So you go ahead.
Oh, my grandfather in 1907 was a veteran of the Spanish-American War, and he was hired by President Roosevelt with his job in Canal Zone as a policeman. And he had been writing to my grandmother, she was 13, as a pen pal. And he was so excited about the job and thought, you know, if he didn't take it right away and go down to Panama, he would lose the job, the position would be filled. So he didn't even tell her, he just went to Panama. And then they started writing again, they picked up their writing. And I have letters, you know, hundreds of their love letters. But he became a policeman and he retired as a commander, a district police commander. And he lived there with his wife, my grandmother, Laura, and they retired in Gamboa. And at that time in the 50s, you were able to retire and stay there. And they died and they were buried at the cemetery in Corzell, along with other relatives there as well. But their life was very interesting and their love letters are you know, exciting to read. And so when I grew up, all my relatives lived there. I had, my mother and father were both born in the Canal Zone. My father was born in Colon in Panama, my mother in the Canal Zone, and so we have six generations that live there, four generations born there. So and one, my great grandfather, he on my mother's side, he went down to help in the construction of the canal. So I have on my paternal side, my grandfather in 1907 was in the police force, and my other great-grandfather was in the construction. He was a mason, and he helped build some of the artwork in the administration building.
He was an artistic mason. Mm-hmm. He was an Irish immigrant that come born in Ireland, came over, met his wife, Molly, who was an immigrant from Sweden, and they came to Panama.
But he was, going back to my police grandfather, he was on the first police force in the Canal Zone that was developed, and my husband closed out in 1982, he was working as a police lieutenant, and so he was on the last platoon and closed out the canal, the Canal Zone police.
Wow.
So
that's a legacy.
Yeah, kind of full circle.
Yeah,
yes.
Full circle.
Right. So, and Karen was born, and I'll let her tell her story, but.
Well, I wanted to just expand on what the administration building is, that mm-hmm. your great-grandfather yeah. did a lot of the, masonry artwork.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That was the building where the governor, who is appointed by, was appointed by the President of the United States, that's where the governor's office was. And so it was this very large, beautiful, just building on the top of the side of a hill that you could see from, you know, many different locations.
On Ancon Hill.
And that's, you know, that was kind of the central point, focal point of the Canal Zone, because that's where the governor's office was.
Mm-hmm.
And his living quarters were just around up the street from the administration building.
And does that building still exist?
Yes, it does. Mm-hmm.
And it's used by the current administration of Panama's Panama Canal, what they call the Authority of the Canal.
Mm-hmm.
That's their administration building as well.
Interesting.
The building, it also housed all the bureau directors of the canal. In the canal zone, you had the canal zone government, which was the administration and authority over the canal, and then you had the Panama Canal Company. The governor of the canal zone had to be a general in the Army Corps of the Engineers. And when he came to the canal zone and took over that position, he took his uniform off, he dropped the title of general, and he used the title governor. And he had absolute authority over the canal zone. In other words, all laws and everything had to be through his authority in there. That was even the military bases. The canal zone police, which was a federal police force, had jurisdiction in the entirety of the canal zone, even on the military bases, which at times got to be a thorn in the side of the military commanders because they're used to having just their base and nobody else, and the canal zone police could go on. But the governor allowed the commanders of the military bases to patrol, police, and administrate their bases in the canal zone with his authority, which would get the governor sometimes in trouble because there was a four-star general down there that ran Southcom, and he was only a two-star general. So a four-star general doesn't like a two-star general telling him what to do or granting him authority to do something. So it got touchy at times for some of the governors. They were in a tight spot. The lieutenant governor of the canal zone had to be a colonel in the Army Corps of the Engineers also. And he dropped his title colonel, and he was lieutenant governor. And the most of the bureau directors were also in the military. Like the port captains were Coast Guards. The Marine Bureau was headed by a Navy captain. So you had a lot of military that had positions in the canal. And the reason was is the Corps of Engineers kind of like to maintain, because of the canal, the construction and the operation of it. You know, they needed to have the military control of it, but you couldn't have a neutral waterway with a military commander. So that's why they dropped those titles. And they went by governor, lieutenant governor, etc. So it was a unique situation.
And the four-star that was in charge of U.S. Southern Command wasn't in charge necessarily of Panama, per se, of the canal zone. He was responsible for, from a military aspect, for Central America, all of Latin America, Central America, South America, and the Caribbean. So even though the headquarters was located within the canal zone, that wasn't his governed area as a commander. So,
as dependents of, you know, of the of Ed's family, he was the main breadwinner in the family. But we worked, I worked for the military for a while up in Quarry Heights, and Karen worked for the military
she,
as well.
She worked for U.S. Southern Command, which was the four-star headquarters. And then when I went back to Panama as an adult, I worked for them as well for 13 years. So.
Can you describe kind of what you did?
It was interesting working at Quarry Heights. It was I was hired as a clerk stenographer, and I had 2 years of college, and I was excited. I bought a car and a little convertible, and Quarry Heights was a very secure base. It was on top of Ancon Hill, and it you could even see the canal, the ships going through the canal. But I worked for, J6 was a directorate, and I worked for every branch of service. So they had the Navy commander, Air Force, Army, and so it was interesting. There were a few battles that went on, you know, here and there, but I was good experience. And later on, I transferred into the transportation branch, was the name under the administration of the governor, and the name slips me right now. We were under Joe Wood, and Anyway, we handled all of the incoming employees that were hired by the canal and the ones that were leaving that decided they didn't want to stay and they wanted to go back to the U.S. And also, every 2 years, you were entitled to travel back to your home of record. You know, the government would pay for your way, your family. So every 2 years, we would take a vacation. And during the summer months, you packed up your kids, and you know, they had charter flights, or we had the ship for a while for really nice, SS Cristobal and the Ancon. And so there were, you know, different ways of traveling back to the States. At first it was by ship, and then later
on.
It was home leave. And we, as a family, as a little girl growing up, I had not been to the States or visited the States until I was a teenager. So I was born in Panama, and so there was a lot of, you know, interesting trips that we made when I was a teenager every 2 years. But and then as a family, when Ed and I were married, we tried to go back every 2 years. Mm-hmm. But it was a wonderful life. It was like a hidden secret. I always, you know, it's still a paradise. We try to go back every year. And I was going to mention that our family is still all connected with the government. Karen has two brothers, one older and one younger. She's the middle one. The older one works for Department of Homeland Security, and he works in Washington, D.C. And prior to his promotion to Washington, D.C., he was transferred to Panama, and he worked at the embassy for 5 years he was there. And he was able to buy a small little beach house. So we still have residence there, you know, through him. And I got my my cedula, because I was born in Panama, and so I'm considered dual citizenship. And but then our youngest son right now is in Kuwait. He's in the army. And he's there for a year, but everyone is in the government. And our oldest son is also in the reserves, Army Reserves. So, and Karen's husband is in the military, in the Army. So he's a colonel, and so we have a lot of connections still with the government. So,
and our youngest son?
I said Kit Tam.
Yeah, he's in the military. He's over in Kuwait right now.
Yeah. So we're, you know, when we were living in the canal zone, the only job you could, you know, that was offered to you was through the government. Mm-hmm. So my first job was I worked at the high school helping with the books and all. And then the next job I had was a usherette at the theater. Mm-hmm. And I actually was a government employee, you know, with my little flashlight and telling people to take their feet off the seats and making popcorn. And then I, you know, moved up from there. Eventually I retired from the government after over 30 years of service. So I also worked for Department of Homeland Security here in the States when we moved back. So mm-hmm. We were first Customs and then, you know, became Department of Homeland Security. But I think we're passing up a lot of life here, but you know, fast forwarding.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's so much to tell. It's hard to get it all.
Well, if we could just go back to the history of how we got there and the families,
right,
and the uniqueness of what involved there was that your first down there was your Grandpa Davis. Mm-hmm. He went down as a policeman, and eventually, was it 1910, I think?
1910.
That he went up and married his long
pen pal
and brought her down to the canal zone, which was still partially jungle and under the construction and everything. So they didn't talk much about it, but I know it had to be quite a cultural shock to come down to that.
And also the hospital that I was born in, my brothers were born in, my mother was born in, my aunts, mm-hmm. cousins, uncles, my grandmother, is called Gorgas Hospital. And Gorgas Hospital was named after an Army general, Army colonel, who was a scientist. And he is the one who invented the cure for malaria. He was sent there because when the U.S. took over the building of the canal from the French, it was because so many were dying from malaria. Mm-hmm. And they had that big problem. And he invented the cure, so they named this hospital after him. And later on, after the treaty implementation was underway, it became an Army hospital. So it was named Gorgas Army Hospital. Mm-hmm. And so it's still there today. It's a college, I believe, an institute.
Didn't he actually discover the cure for yellow fever?
Yes,
yellow fever. Mm-hmm. He initiated a program of cleaning up the still waters around mm-hmm. the area and eliminating the larvae in the water. Growing up in the canal zone, we had our mosquitoes and bugs. But here in Florida, I have more. A lot more.
What about Benning, Georgia?
Yeah. Well, that's because they spray with DDT, heavily spray, and you have a lot of side effects from DDT. And so I think.
It gives you gray hair.
Yeah.
But anyhow, so he came down, and you kind of briefed over his history. The canal was like, it's a strip 254 miles wide. And so it was 5 miles on either side of the center line. And where it deviated from that was the water of the rivers and the lakes that provided the water for the canal. That went out where the water went back up on the lake, and you had the canal zone then went 100 feet from the mean high water mark. So we had 100 feet beyond that where the water touched it. So that spread out beyond the 5 miles. So you had 250 square miles of land, 500. That was divided in two, so you had two districts. You had the Atlantic and you had the Pacific. Mm-hmm. Okay. And we commonly refer to those as the other side. If you lived in Balboa, anybody from Cristobal lived on the other side, vice versa. So you'll probably hear that. They were from the other side.
Mm-hmm. And so, those of us that have spouses that are not from there, we just say, when you meet people, no matter what side they say they're from, say you're from the other side. It's a joke. And a lot of people's spouses do that. I'm from the other side.
So anyhow, he started out mainly in the Atlantic side, which is also referred to as the north, because the ships going through the canal travel north and south. Mm-hmm. So a northbound would be going from the Pacific Ocean to the Atlantic, and southbound would be going to the Pacific, which is also unique. If you look at the map, the bend of the canal, it's, I don't know too many places in the world where you wake up in the morning and look out over the Pacific Ocean and watch the sunrise. And to get to the United States driving from Balboa, you had to drive south at first to go north. You're actually heading north, but you were driving south because of the shape of the land. Mm-hmm. So it's a unique place like that.
If that doesn't confuse you.
I think I'm following. So the north, the different sides, that's really interesting. Were there big cultural differences, or was there contention between the different sides?
Yes.
Or was it just, and
you had the Balboa Bulldogs, which was the Pacific side, mm-hmm. and you had the Cristobal Tigers, which was the Atlantic side. Cristobal was blue and gold, Balboa was red and white. Mm-hmm. So we always had the football games, big, you know. Mm-hmm. You talk about content. And also, each will say their side was the better side. Mm-hmm. It's like I started out in the Atlantic side. Mm-hmm. And I remember when my father got his job, to go to the Pacific, he changed his jobs. He came and he sat us down.
There were 9 children in his family.
Mm-hmm.
He sat us down. He says, "We're moving to Balboa." He says, "I have to go over there because of my job." And he says, "Now I want you to know, when you go over there, you're going to have to wear shoes and a shirt. You can't run around like this." And we were all crying. On the Atlantic side, I knew all of the football players on the high school when I was in kindergarten. I knew all the football players on the football team, all the baseball players, the basketball players, all the sports. I knew their names, who their girlfriends were. I knew who their cheerleaders were. I knew where all of them lived. And that's the way it was. And I can remember my older brother and I would be telling my dad, we got to go to the football. The Tigers are playing tonight. We got to go to the football game or the basketball game. You know, and it was a tighter community very over tight. There. It was very
smaller.
Close. Yeah,
it was smaller.
When you went to Balboa, you had your cliques, because then you had Balboa, then you had Diablo, which is another town site, then you had Ancon, was another one, and then you had Los Rios, and Corozal.
Different town sites.
Then the military bases. Mm-hmm. So you... Even though we went, we got to school, when you got into junior high school and high school, we all went to one school on our side. Mm-hmm. And that's where you met everybody in there. Before that, you didn't meet everybody so much.
I wanted to say, we used to ride the train going, you know, back and forth. Mm-hmm. So you were, you know, once you were in junior high, your parents would let you ride the train and you'd get on with all the other kids. And
or in my generation, when you were like five, well, you could ride the train with your friends.
So it was very safe.
Yes.
Yes, it was very safe. That's plus, my father was a conductor on the train. So, and he was a well-paid employee. He, at that time, he earned a very good salary. He retired, he died but from skin cancer. So, but he worked for the railroad for 30 years.
My older brother used to work with my grandfather on the railroad. Mm-hmm. And the Miami Herald actually sent a reporter down to the Canal Zone one time. They did a big article in the Miami Herald. It was on the front page, called The Youngest Conductor in the World. And it was my brother and my grandfather. My brother was 8, I think.
Yeah.
And my grandfather and him were hanging out at the side of the train, and he would go and check the bathrooms and take the tickets. And so they did this big article on him. And
You have to
tell the story that our son, Karen's brother Eddie, she was talking about. He would be able to walk back and forth from coach to coach, and when you passed over, you would actually from coach to coach, you were exposed to the elements. You could fall off the train. There was, you know, it was just this, the iron stairs that came up, and so you could hear the linkage of the train moving, and you'd go from coach to coach. And so Eddie got used to doing that by himself. And when you went to the men's room, or, you know, it was a co-ed thing, you could actually watch the tracks, you know, through the commode. Yeah. And so as a little boy, 8 years old, that was fun, you know, so he would, you know, he would kind of get lost in there. And this one train trip that my father took Eddie on, he couldn't find him. My father couldn't find his grandson. And
derailed.
And the train had derailed. And so they got the train back on the tracks and they started up again, and no grandson. So my father stopped the train, and, you know, the engineer got off the train, and all the baggage people got off the train, and passengers, they were looking, you know, for Eddie, and all of a sudden Eddie poked his head off the train. He was like, what's going on, you know, what's going on? He said, where have you been? He was in the bathroom playing, you know, with the toilet, watching the action of the tracks going by.
And throwing toilet paper.
Yeah. And here everyone was off the train looking for him. He was, you know, what are you doing?
But my father was born in White Plains, New York, and went to Panama when he was 2 years old. So, I don't know.
So how does, are there differing sentiments that you guys just witnessed between people who were born there and then people who were born in the States and moved there?
It as everywhere you go, when you come in, you work your way into the community and within the people. Mm-hmm. You make your own way as your personality, character, and whatnot. Mm-hmm. In the military, we're coming and going. It's normally a 2-3 year tour. They're down there. So you will have people coming into your life, and then you see them and you get to know them, you become friends, and 2 or 3 years are gone. Like, we're having our 50th class reunion this year. And a lot of the people in our class, a lot of the people in our class were military, but they're Zonians. It's in them.
It's in their blood.
The highlight of their life was living in the canal zone, being part of it.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people got out of the military and went back to live there because mm-hmm. the lifestyle was so wonderful. You had the best of both worlds.
Mm-hmm. I have to say, Ed's mother, raising 9 children, every kid in the neighborhood was welcome to sit at their table. So their house, they had no air conditioning, and most of us growing up didn't have air conditioning or a television until we were about 14. I was 14. But his mother, I mean, everyone in the neighborhood would love to go to the Dolan's house. And at Christmas time, it wasn't Christmas, because we just put up Christmas lights. There was no snow, you know, wasn't anything to change, you know, the weather or anything. But the Dolan house had silhouettes of every family. And, you know, it was black silhouettes of all, the whole family. And then it was Merry Christmas from the Dolans.
Right.
And until you saw that, because they lived in a house that was pretty, it was
right by the railroad tracks.
So everyone, when you drive by, everyone would see their house. So until that came up, then you knew it was Christmas time, you know. But their house was a very warm, friendly. So wherever they moved, they always did well with getting into the community. But Ed's father became a fire chief. And he was, I'll let Ed tell, he was very close to the bomberos in Panama. And he provided a lot of the old fire trucks to the Panamanian Fire Department. And they were very close to a lot of the people in Panama. So are we. But still, we still consider Panama, as our hearts are still there. And our hearts, you know, we're happy to live in the U.S. because there's nothing greater, as far as I'm concerned. But there's nothing greater than being in Panama either. But, you know, it's just, we've had the best of both worlds. Yeah.
That's home, and that's the way we feel.
It's like coming from a small town. Yeah. You know, my husband grew up in a small town in South Dakota on a farm. Mm-hmm. And that's how he feels about his hometown. And everybody knows each other, and they're all friends on Facebook.
Right.
It's a smaller version of it, because his town didn't even have a street light or a stop sign. They had stop signs, but not street light. Mm-hmm. What are they?
Traffic lights.
Traffic lights. Mm-hmm. They didn't even have any. It was so small. There was mm-hmm. one small grocery store. His graduating class had, I think, 19 kids in it. Mm-hmm. But it's that same relationship that you have from a small town, because in the canal zone, you had generation upon generation. You know, my children, one of them was born in Panama, but we left when he was 8 months old. They didn't know any of this, but yet when we come to the canal zone reunion, to the Panama reunion, which is where we're at now, they immediately feel like this is their family, because this is people that know not only me, that know them, that know their grandparents. Right. And it's even though you may not have personally known the person, you have an instant bond and instant connection, because you're from the same place. Your grandparents knew each other, your parents knew each other, and you feel like family. So it's the same small town, even though it was larger in scale. It's like being from a small town here in the United States.
What did Colin tell you?
My youngest, that's 10, we were preparing to come here, and he said, "Well, Mom, how come I wasn't born in Panama?" And I said, "Well, because we didn't live there when you were born." And he said, "Well, you should have made me born in Panama. You're a bad mother. You're making me born." He was just teasing, but
yeah.
We were, I guess, because we were surrounded by Costa Rica and Colombia and in the water, Pacific Ocean and the Atlantic Ocean, that everyone helped each other out. You know, everyone knew what was happening. It was a very close-knit community, whether you were on the Pacific side or the Atlantic side. Mm-hmm. And you know, coming here, I still meet some of my parents' friends. They're still alive. And they'll, you know, it's just, you spend at the reunions, and we come almost every year that we can. It's a lot of 4 days of hugging and, you know, just going over stories like this. Mm-hmm. And we're just very blessed to have lived there. We have a lot of Panamanian friends. And at first, when the treaty was signed, we were upset because my husband lost his job. The Canal Zone Police closed. Mm-hmm. And so we went through a really difficult transition in leaving there, and never living in the States, and never owning a home, all these things. And Karen you were 14 when we left. So it was really difficult for Karen and Eddie to leave their friends and Tim behind. But now that it's in retrospect, and I never thought I would say this, but it's been, I think really good for Panama. So there's good and there's bad, but we lost our home. But but it's been good for the country. And they're getting there. They're not there yet. You know, and we were talking about that this morning, Ed and I, about how they've come a long way from just a small, undeveloped country to where, you know, now, I mean, they've got a canal that they're responsible for, and it's working.
And the canal is a very difficult operation, not just in the moving of the ships and all that. The maintenance on the canal is unbelievable.
Yeah.
That is a maintenance nightmare. And for Panamanians to do maintenance, that was a big fear, you know, because it's not in their culture, you know. And they've done a great job with it, because when you talk about maintenance, you're not just talking about the locks themselves. Annually, they have to take gates off, repair them, overhaul them, put them back on. They have to overhaul the chambers and everything. You have to keep constantly dredge the canal because the weight of the land pushes the dirt up, so they're always dredging it. Now they're building the new canal, and even while they're doing this, they still got to maintain all the vehicles, all the boats, the tugboats, everything, the locks, the docks, everything. And it's a huge job, and they're doing a good job at it. When you go down there, the canal looks just like when we had it, exactly the same. The only difference is the flags on the boat are different.
Mm-hmm. It's the area around it is different. I mean, they don't have the people to staff and to maintain the grounds and certain things. But it's like we said, it's working. Have you ever been to the canal? You have to go.
Yeah, I've been thinking this entire time. I need to go down.
We'll be your tour guide.
Great. Another thing too, that historically our family has there is the annual ocean to ocean Cayuga race, which goes from the Atlantic side to the Pacific side. It's a 3-day race. That a Cayuga is like a large canoe. It's made from a tree, or now I think they make them from different stuff, but years ago. But my father was in one of the first races, and my brother and I raced when I was 13, and we would get up before school and go out at like 4 o'clock in the morning and paddle out in the canal, and it was still dark and you could see the phosphorus on the water on the paddles. And we would do this for like a good 6 months before the race. And the goal was to finish the race. We didn't even care about winning so much because a lot of boats didn't finish. It was that grueling. It
took 3 days.
3 days, and you had escort boats, and you would go from one point to one point and then stay the night and then get up at the crack of dawn and go and do the next leg of the race. And and then you would go through the locks and hold on to ropes, and then you would lower through the locks, you know, in these little wooden boats, you know. And
was it two to a boat?
Four people in a boat was the boats that were competing. Then they had the bigger kind of like boats that run it for fun, which might have like 20 people. Like
one was named Cardiac Arrest,
which was like older people, you know, that just did it for fun. But the competing boats had four people, and there was all male teams, all female teams, and then there were co-ed.
You were in Explorers.
I was in the follow through.
Okay. But I mean the
you had to join the Scouts.
Right, you had to join the Scouts. Right.
I said Boy Scouts. Mm-hmm. Boy Scouts of America were the sponsors of it when the U.S. had the canal. Now they have the Regatta de something where people have continued on. They formed a paddling club, as they call it.
And now they come from all over the world to race.
To race.
Yeah, they come from Europe. They come. It's grown tremendously. It's a huge annual race every year.
Do you guys go down for it usually?
So we have. Yes.
Mm-hmm. That'd be
not every year, but it's in April. Yeah, and it's
when our oldest boy Eddie lived down there. He's working the embassy. He paddled in it 5 years in a row.
Well, he was there for 5 years, so I think he four years, because 1 year he did.
Yeah, and he paddled in it once when before we left down there, and he was in a winning boat then, and he never could get in the winning boat. They were always second place. So 4 years he was there.
But the boat he was in when we were there as children was on display in Cocoa Beach in a surf shop. Because there was another family, the Grimason family, that still paddles. They go back and paddle it. And they had, I don't know if he purchased the boat or if it's his boat or what.
It belongs to a museum.
Well, he had it displayed in it's called Cocoa Beach Surf Company or something. And it was on display there, actually.
The Due Process.
The Due Process is the name of the boat, yeah.
Frank Townsend. He is a professor at the University of Florida. Mm-hmm. I don't know what department or whatnot. I think he has his doctorate. He might be Dr. Frank. But anyhow, he wrote a little article for the museum on the Cayuga race. He and I we did about two races together in the same scout troop. Mm-hmm. And he's got a little story on there. You know, I have a copy of it in the room. But he wrote it, and he could, you know, maybe he'll have a copy and you could get from him and see it, and gives you a little insight into what it was to go through.
Yeah, you said you were in the first race, is that?
No, I wasn't in the first, but I was like in the second, third. I did five races. And first one I was in, I think, was, let's see, I won in 59.
I thought that he said in his story that the first race was in 1959, because
it was 56.
Okay.
And I don't know if I was in 56. I probably might have been, but the last 2 years I was in, our boat came in first, and he wasn't in the boat, which was disappointing, because he tried all that time and they never got it. And our boat is very. His father was the scoutmaster, Mr. Red Townsend, and he got us this boat. It was a river cayuco. Mm-hmm. It was called a piragua, which wasn't set low in the water. Didn't have much freeboard, but it was narrow and fast. We used that, and. So he painted it fire engine red, and then he painted in white letters, and the name of the boat was Cógeme Si Puede, which means catch me if you can. He says, now you better win, and we won 2 years in a row.
That's great.
So that was good. But I wanted to go back earlier where we were talking about, you know, living down there and people coming in and moving out, and how did we feel? One thing was, after leaving the canal, when our career ended down there and we had to leave, we came up here. I have always felt different. Now, I'm born in the United States. I'm retired from the military. I did 4 years active duty in the Navy, and I did 23 years in the reserves. So I'm not isolated from Americans or being around them, but I feel different. I am different. I know I'm different. And since the treaty, we've got the name Zonians. We're Zonians. A Zonian is somebody that was either born and or lived in the canal zone, was raised in the canal zone. And it was a derogatory term at first, used against us. When the treaty went And prior to the treaty, we got a lot of bad press down there. Congress called us gutless sheep. A lot of derogatory terms were used against us. And in the treaty, they were saying we lived outlandishly. We abused the Panamanians. They said that we coerced them out of things, and we had too many churches in the canal zone. And we had manicured lawns, and we lived way above the means of all Americans, which we didn't. Mm-hmm. Our pay was actually less than the standard government employee. And
gave us a differential for living there, mm-hmm. which raised it a little bit.
All the money, the Panama Canal didn't cost U.S. taxpayers one penny. All the money that was made with the Panama Canal went back into the running of the Panama Canal and paying the employees and everything that it took to maintain it.
Yeah.
And so
plus it paid back the debt of building
the tolls that were brought in by the shipping, by the ships.
And the police, we gave a ticket out for speeding, for parking, whatever. And you went into court and you got a fine for whatever crime you had and you paid your fine. Those monies from the tickets and from the fines in court did not go to the Canal Zone government. They went to the U.S. Treasury. We didn't get it, went up there.
But it was a very low crime area, you know. And even the people in Panama that lived there that were poor, they might look at you and say, oh, you're a rich gringo, you know, but they would not kill you. You know, they might steal your money, but you were going to survive it, you know.
Well, that's because the political machine in Panama blamed the U.S. for everything.
Mm-hmm. I just want to make something comment before I forget it. In one of the letters that I was reading over my grandparents' letters, love letters, they were having difficulties in my grandmother was not receiving letters from him and worrying about him, and she was very young, and it was a romance that really started with the letters as pen pals. But he, in one of his letters, he writes, you know, I look for so forward to receiving your letters. The women here, the girls here are beautiful, but their skin is too dark for me, so you don't have to worry. But anyway, there are letters that are so beautiful just to read, and Karen and I were talking about trying to put together a book based on this love story. So, but it's so go ahead, Ed, and I wanted to just didn't want to forget that, you know. He says certain things in his letters about where he worked. One was Bohio. I've never heard of that town before.
Yeah, but a
lot of the towns went underwater when they...
They're construction towns.
Yeah. Construction towns. So when the canal started full swing, all these towns no longer exist, and a lot of artifacts and things went, you know, into the mud, into the water. But there's Gorgona, Bohio,
Empire,
Culebra.
Yeah, Empire.
Empire.
Empire became part of the military ranges they had for artillery ranges, bombing ranges, and that. And Empire was a town used in the construction, and then that closed down. Then we got the major towns on either side of the canal.
Ed's 50th class reunion, there's 120 people here. Mm-hmm. And after 50 years, that's a pretty good turnout.
Yeah.
From how many were in your high school class?
I don't know.
Probably maybe 200 at the most,
yeah.
You think?
Yeah, it was over 200.
No, I was just going to go into like what it was like growing up there.
That'd be fantastic.
Yeah. I had to write a kind of a story for a group that I was in with my church, and I kind of started with my childhood, and the way that I describe it, and I tell friends that are not from Panama, my friends that I met after moving here to the United States, is, you know, life growing up there was, you know, we would wake up in the morning if it, like during the summertime when we didn't come to the States on home leave, we would wake up in the morning and we would be gone all day. You didn't have to go home to eat lunch because you could either throw a rock at a mango tree or take a stick or climb the tree and get the mango and eat it. And you could get avocados or bananas or whatever.
Rose
apples, different fruits.
Ginups
were another type of fruit we would eat. And then you'd just go to a water, somebody's hose on the side of their house and drink the water because the water was some of the best water in the world in terms of the purity and purification naturally from the Chagres River. And so then we would come home at the end of the day when, you know,
the street lights came on.
And that's not just my upbringing. My parents went through the same thing. My grandmother used to tell the same story.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, this was generations that just grew up this way. Mm-hmm. And so when we moved to the United States, it was very different because you didn't have the securities, you know.
The freedom
to do that. And just like my father's story about having to wear shoes, you know, moving from the Atlantic to the Pacific, well, I grew up running around without shoes too, you know, climbing trees and playing, you know, football on the fields and stuff. And then when we moved to the United States, it was the same thing. You know, nobody went around barefoot. And so it was kind of the same dynamic for me, the experience.
I wanted to say that there were two hills that you liked to climb.
Right.
And you, one hill was where the administration building was located, and they used to get the palm fronds from the trees, and you can tell the story.
Yeah, we would slide down. We would get the dead palm fronds and get, you know, a whole bunch of us, and like almost like a sled, but a tree palm hill. Yeah, and the hill kind of had slopes. And so we would all get on it like a train, and we would slide down it, or we would get cardboard, or we would even ride our bikes. We would kind of go zigzag down the different levels of the hill and get, you know, daring enough to ride our bikes. There were huge drainage ditches because in Panama it rains, 9 months out of the year. So there were drainage ditches probably 6 feet deep, maybe deeper. And we used to use those as water slides. And I tell my husband now, if my children were doing what I did, I would have been mortified because the water would come fast and furious down these huge hills. And the only thing at the end of it were these metal bars. But I mean, I remember our legs would get stuck in there and all the kids would be pulling us, you know, and we'd go, there were lines of like 20 or 30 kids, and we would all wait, and we would go sliding down these big drainage ditches.
Sounds like a dream.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Where did you guys move to? When you were 14, where do you relocate to in the United States?
We moved to Jacksonville, Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason we moved to Jacksonville, because Ed's parents had, his father retired from the police chief, mm-hmm. position, and they
fire chief,
and they moved to Jacksonville because an older son went there. You know, you didn't really know where to go, so you went where you had some family. And
what year was that in?
That was in 1982.
And then I moved back in 1994 as an adult, and I worked for the Army.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then Karen's brother, older brother, was hired by, at the time, U.S. Customs, mm-hmm. and he worked out west in Arizona and for 3 years, and then they selected him transferred him to Panama because Karen speaks fluent Spanish, and so does Eddie, and so he worked there at the embassy for 5 years under U.S. Customs, mm-hmm. at the attaché office, and then they transferred him back to D.C. for right now, but there's a possibility he may go back.
We speak Spanish because we grew up, you know, even though my mother was a secretary at the time, my father was a police officer, we had a maid, we had a gardener, we had a boat. Mm-hmm. My grandfather had an island. We would go to the beach all the time, so we lived the life. We lived, you know, an amazing life. You had access to so many things that... Mm-hmm. Here back in the United States, to be able to have all those things, you would have had to be pretty wealthy. Mm-hmm. But because of the nature of being in Panama, and a lot of the local Panamanians that were of the lower income would work as maids or gardeners in the canal zone because the Americans paid better than the wealthier Panamanians did. And so the lady that worked for us, Angelica, she was like a second mother. I mean, you know, go back and visit her, and every time we were there, and she was part of our family. We were going to bring her to the United States when we moved, but she had gotten married and had a child, and she was actually torn on whether to come with us. Right. And, you know, but her husband was there, and there was that closeness and that connection with the people that work for you. They became your family. Mm-hmm. And so she didn't speak English and we didn't speak Spanish, and you just taught each other and you learned how to speak the language. And
when we grew up there,
our maids were Jamaican.
Our maids were of West Indian extraction. The U.S. brought the West Indians to the canal as laborers to build the canal. Mm-hmm. And they became fantastic employees.
And so you speak the Asian language. Let's talk it.
Yeah. So they wanted to stay because they were living better than they would in Jamaica or the other islands. Mm-hmm. So they worked out a treaty with Panama, and Panama allowed them to come in. In fact, told them if they stayed, they could opt to become Panamanian citizens. So they came and brought their spouses and children over, and they raised their families there. So doing this, they were on a different wage scale than the U.S. So for additional income, plus those that left the canal and lived in Panama, they would come over and they hire on as maids, you know, with the employees in the canal zone. That's what Bonnie and I, our maids were of West Indian extraction.
Give them your accent.
Yeah.
They want to hear your accent.
Yeah. See, we weren't from the islands, you know, but with the people there, we learned to speak the language. We need to eat what they eat, you know. For breakfast, we don't have pound cake. We have bigs. See, you get bigs with it. You know, and you learn to drink your coffee, you put the carnation canned milk rather than the other milk, you know, and you just learn all these mannerisms. Okay. In fact, to this day, when I go into a store and I'm talking to the person there at the counter and I hear their accent, I know they're from the islands, mm-hmm. and I say, I think I hear the sweetness of the island coming out of your voice, you know. And they look at me, where are you from?
I have to add something here. Not only did we learn how to cook Jamaican-style foods, mm-hmm. you know, Latin foods. I mean, we still to this day, you know, our favorite foods are arroz con pollo, mm-hmm. sancocho, empanadas. We made empanadas, ceviche we brought here. You know, and when we get together as a family, that's the type of food we cook. Mm-hmm. So,
well, even at home, like my husband, he's not from there. He has been there many times with his career in the military. Mm-hmm. But he makes some of the best arroz con pollo and, you know, in our family. I mean, he makes it because we cook it as a meal in mm-hmm. our house all the time. Our kids love it. And it's like chili or tacos. I mean, it's arroz con pollo. It's another staple in our house.
It's the empanadas is a little interesting story. We grew up with our empanadas in the canal zone. And the ones in Panama were a little bit different. And we didn't think much of it. An empanada is an empanada. You know what they are. It's like a pie, a meat mm-hmm. pie. Okay. And so when we left and we come back to Panama, all of a sudden, they didn't have our empanadas anymore. They only had the Panamanian style.
Fried ones.
We couldn't find it. You know, what was the problem? Well, I went online, I started researching it, and I found out wherever the Jamaicans go, they take the patty with them.
Jamaican beef patty.
Ours was a version of the Jamaican beef patty. Mm-hmm. See, the Jamaican will put the turmeric, it makes it yellow. We didn't do that, and they kind of come square.
And they bake them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we finally figured out everybody was saying, no, this is a real, nobody was putting the recipe together because we weren't looking at the Jamaican patty. And that was a Jamaican influence.
But it was so common, like in our school, when I went to junior high school, that was the first time we had a cafeteria, because in elementary school, you had to take your lunch. They didn't have cafeterias.
They went home.
Well, at the junior high school in the cafeteria, they had machines that had empanadas. I mean, kind of like you would get a hamburger or maybe a hot dog here in school cafeteria machines or something. They had the Jamaican beef empanadas were in there and foods like that.
We sounds had, better than a beef.
We so had, it was just normal food. That's like a hamburger, you know.
There was also a dish called Johnny Mazzetti that originally came from somewhere in the U.S. And there are several families that say, that was my grandmother's recipe. No, that was my grandmother's recipe. So everyone claims that this originated from their family. But it somehow became one of our, you know, our when we socialize, someone would bring a dish called Johnny Mazzetti, and it's basically meat, like ground round, the egg noodles, the white egg noodles, like a spaghetti sauce, olives, and lots of garlic and onions, so and cheese.
Kind of like a quicker version of lasagna.
Yeah, yeah. And it's where Johnny Mazzetti, where he was from, or you know,
his
how that
mother
came.
Probably. It's yeah. the creator of the
yeah.
recipe,
yeah. or his wife, Mazzetti. So it's in all of our cookbooks, Johnny Mazzetti. It's not a Latin, you know, dish, but it's in the Zonian, you know, Zonian culture, right?
As a kid growing up, you would be involved in different sporting and scouting activities, and there was a lot of activities for kids. And then you would have, like, at the end of the Cayuga race, you'd have a big dinner. Or you've swimming races, you'd have a dinner, and the baseball season dinners. Well, the dinners would either be fried fish or be Johnny Mazzetti, because you make up a batch and everybody could sit down and do it. So that's, everybody knows Johnny Mazzetti, and it's a favorite dish of us.
You'll hear it throughout your interviews and coming home when the street lights.
Right. And during the summers that we would stay in Panama in the Canal Zone, I remember my brothers and all of our, everybody who stayed, you were either going home to the States for home leave or you were staying. So if you were staying, your friends and you would get together and you would sign up through the school system for the summer programs. And I mean, I did archery, tennis, swimming, gymnastics, kickball, tetherball, ping pong, dodgeball. Square dancing. I mean, you were gone in the morning. You would take your lunch, or you would go to the cafeteria or something, or whatever for lunch,
or eat someone else's lunch,
or eat your friends. But you were gone every day, all day, and parents didn't have to drop you off. They didn't have to stay with you. You would walk, you know, and go to the different places, or you would take the bus that cost. You could take the expensive bus that was 10 cents, which was the big orange, like old school bus, mm-hmm. or you could take the Chiba bus, which was a falling apart jalopy bus that had these dangling balls and the Chiba music and stuff. And you would, if you had 5 cents, you would take that bus. And and so that's what we would do during the summer. And so now, as a mother with young children, and the summertime comes here, and I keep looking for these summer programs, and I live on a military installation in Georgia, and it's just, you don't have that dynamic. You have to pay for these programs. You have to take your children, be there with your children, unless you can build enough of a relationship to trust whoever it is you're leaving them with. So it's a whole different dynamic raising children now, and I'm sure maybe this is just a generational thing too. It's mm-hmm. probably not just a Canal Zone thing, because my husband shares some of the same stories growing up, the freedoms that he had.
You used to walk to the movie theater, mm-hmm. they'd walk home at night, you know.
They're in elementary school.
Yeah. Go to school, walk to school. I was going to say something about feeling special. You were saying you feel different. You were feeling different. I think it's because you have, like in our family, you have six generations that lived in a country overseas. Mm-hmm. And you became, it was a different culture in a way. There's a slogan, land divided, the world united, when they built the canal. And we had every culture, because of all the people that came to build the canal, every culture in almost an entire world lived there. And the stronger the stronger countries like China, Africa, Spain, those countries were highly, there were a lot of people, so their food and their ways were strong influences on our lives. And so we were introduced to so many wonderful people by living there. And so you do feel different in that way. We're not different than anybody in the U.S. because we all have stories to tell, you know, whether you were from the Canal Zone or not. But
and most importantly, our loyalty and our hearts. We are American. I mean, we were in the 4th of July parade every year. I mean, it was a very American community. Mm-hmm. Within another culture. So that's why I say you had the best of both worlds, because you had, we had the pride of being an American. We grew up with American traditions, with American values, just everything that goes along with being American, but we were also exposed to these other cultural influences, which were so important in our, in shaping who we became in life. And so,
as a family, our, one of our home leaves, we decided to drive to the States. Karen was little thing, you know,
three.
She's 3 years old. But we packed up, we bought a camper, and we drove from Panama to the U.S. And then we shipped the camper back on the SS Cristobal, I guess it was, and we came back by ship. But you know, that you can't do that now, you know, without having a, you know,
there's too many wars,
a lot of firearms and, you know, with you and protection. But it would, it's the Pan American Highway, and it's unfortunate because it's a beautiful, beautiful trip.
We were in the Bicentennial parade, which
1976.
Uh-huh. Which was the 100th
anniversary
of the Declaration of Independence, the establishment of America.
Right.
And so my mom and I wore the bonnets and the long dresses, and my dad had the wig and the big long bayonet type gun, and my brothers, we all dressed it, and we had big floats, and we had a parade that went from the town of Gamboa, which was halfway between the Atlantic side and the Pacific side. So the parade went from the town of Gamboa all the way down into the town of Balboa, which was right on the city limits of Panama on the Pacific side. And it was a huge, I mean, I don't know how many, of course my memory might be a little bit,
there was a lot of floats,
people involved.
We drove from Gamboa to Balboa.
Okay.
We didn't
march.
We weren't afloat, you know, the floats, but I mean, there was, everybody was involved, mm-hmm. you know, everybody was part of it. And when I was in, Girl Scouts, we would march in the parade, and there were always parades for every American holiday. Mm-hmm. Memorial Day, Veterans Day, Independence Day, just every American holiday, everybody was out in full force. There were picnics. We had a tradition every year after, in January, after Christmas holiday, people would go around and collect real Christmas trees. And all the different little townships would have Christmas tree burns. And people would come and bring food and drinks and chairs, and the kids would run around and play, and the fire department would monitor it, because they would put all the Christmas trees in a big pile, and they would have this huge Christmas tree bonfire. And so it was, you looked forward to Christmas, but then you looked forward to the bonfire tree burn afterwards.
You didn't burn the whole big pile. You'd start off maybe like six trees, and then the families would get trees, and they'd come up and they'd throw it on. It'd be somebody direct them. You keep it going.
And the town that my parents live in here in Florida, in DeLand, not too far from Orlando, some friends of theirs live on a large piece of, like, I don't know how many acres, 20 acres or whatever piece of land. And they started doing this, and people were coming from different parts of the state from that grew up in the Canal Zone and would bring their trees, and they were doing this tree burn. But then, I guess, and the local fire department came a couple times to monitor it.
They were supposed to notify them.
Right, but then eventually they were told they had to stop it or whatever because the forest burns and it was too much of a risk. Mm-hmm. But people were coming, you know, from 4 and 5 hours away to go to this tree burn.
How much time do we have left? Are we running out, or?
Well, it's really up to you guys.
Yeah, I know he has an interview at 10:30, so he might have to slip
it's
out.
It's in here.
It's in here.
Yeah.
Okay, that's right. Yeah.
I would like to add just one thing about coming here. When Joe Wood asked us if we would be part of the interview, I said definitely yes, because to keep this alive, you know, and to be able to somehow, you know, pass on to other generations what we experienced. It's so unique that living where you could see ships passing through the canal, from ships from all over the world, when you were going to work or going to school or playing outside in your yard, and you know, it was not that you took it for granted, but it was just part of your life. Mm-hmm. You know, being in the Cayuga race, they would paddle right next to this, ship.
Navy battleship.
Yeah, the Navy, or the love boat, going through, and all the passengers.
Queen Elizabeth.
Yeah. And there they were, in these little, wooden, boats that just, would hold 4 people. But their paddles that they would make, they would make the boats and the paddles. And originally you would get an Indian to actually, take a big tree log and carve your boat, and then they would take it and fine tune it and mm-hmm. shave it down, and and this is how these boats were made.
Well, when I went through, you had to, the only thing you could repair the boat with was tin and tar.
Oh, okay.
And you couldn't wax it. Now, in the current ones, and when you went through, you were able to wax it. You could smooth up, finish the hull out.
Now they're
smooth.
Even fiberglass.
Yeah, and then they cut. Yeah. They cut most of the wood away, and they put canvas and paint the canvas and make it lighter and everything. Mm-hmm.
The one thing that you left out was that
I'm not till 10:30. I just wonder where I'm going.
Thank you.
Being at, when you were in the Boy Scouts, you used to go up into by the Chagres River, and he would wear now they call them thongs. Like the Indians. Mm-hmm. And you would spend, weeks up there at a time living in the jungle? And he was a lifeguard in high school, Ed was, but a very strong swimmer, but you spent a lot of time in the jungle. Hmm. Go ahead.
The last question on here says, how did you interface with the U.S. military and the Panamanian people? And how important was the Panamanian culture in our life? And we've touched upon that, but I just kind of wanted to bring it full circle, because most families that ended up in the Canal Zone were there because of the U.S. military. Mm-hmm. In some way, shape, or form. And a lot of them went to the country in the military, and then either went back to live because they loved it and they worked for the federal government, or whatever those dynamics were. But I now am 42 years old. My husband is a colonel in the U.S. Army. We live on Fort Benning, Georgia. And I have people that I live right down the street from that there is another colonel. His father was a 4-star general in charge of U.S. Southern Command in Panama. So the dynamics and the influence of the Canal Zone are still in my daily life. We still talk about it. We talk about his childhood when he was there, and as a military child living in Panama. There's another lady that's down the street who's the spouse who grew up in, not in the Canal Zone, but in Panama, and she married a service member, and she lived right down the street from me on Fort Benning, Georgia. There's an entire group of military students from the Panamanian police force and military that go to school and they're training with the U.S. military on Fort Benning, Georgia. I mean, as we speak. So the dynamics are still there and the influence is still there. It's just at a different level. Mm-hmm. But the interface, I guess, is still there, is what I'm trying to get at.
My father went down Panama Canal in 1942 early. He couldn't get in the military, but he was a captain in a volunteer fire department in New York. So he and his brother, they saw the need for firemen that was advertised in the canal zone. So they applied. So they went down there as part of the war effort. And they went down early 42. 1944, my mother, older brother, and I, we went down. And we flew down there in the China Clipper. It took us over a month and a half to get down there because the plane would take off and would be flying to Panama and an engine would have problems. They would turn around and go back because if they got to Panama, they wouldn't be able to get the parts to fix the engine. So anyhow, we eventually made it. And then after the war, my father and his brother decided to stay. And that's how I got down in there. But we went down as part of the war effort.
Being down there during the war too, I can remember the sirens going off. We'd have scares that maybe an unidentified plane would fly near the canal, mm-hmm. and so we had bomb shelters that our parents would scoop us up out of bed and we'd run to the bomb shelter and stay there for the rest of the night. And I can remember because that was such a frightening thing to experience. Mm-hmm.
You'd see all the troops going through the canal, going over, and then you'd see them coming back. You'd see ships coming through that had war damage, like aircraft carriers. The Franklin came through, and it was just a mess, a real big mess. But my father took my older brother and I out by the beach in Colon, and we watched a ship go through the breakwater wall, and they had a submarine net, and they had a boat that would lower the net, let him out, and there was a minefield. And we saw the ship go out. We were sitting there, all of a sudden we heard a big explosion. And we were wondering, what's that? And wait a little bit, and then there was another explosion. And we saw some boats going, planes took off and everything. And a little bit later, that ship came back in. It had holes on both sides. It had been torpedoed just outside. So the war was right outside of us there. And we found out later that the plan, Japan was going to bomb the canal. Mm-hmm. They had submarines bringing planes over to bomb it. Mm-hmm. We had over 500,000 servicemen in the canal zone during the war. A lot of people didn't know that. Every hill had an anti-aircraft gun sight on it. Mm-hmm. So military was just everywhere. We grew up with the military everywhere.
But you couldn't date them. You weren't allowed. You were called... rat bait. If you say when you were in high school, if you went to the junior college there, it later became acceptable.
Yeah. Like my generation, a lot of them are military spouse.
Yeah. Well,
it changed.
She was rat bait.
Right.
That's great.
I hope we didn't bore you.
Not at all. This has been fantastic. Oh, yeah. Thank you guys so much.
If you ever want to hear more stories,
I think we definitely
and there's pictures on Facebook. That was what I was going to bring up. Is Facebook has been, I mean, I remember somebody posting. I don't remember who, but somebody, one of my Facebook friends said, "Is it just us Zonians, or do most people have 300 or 400 mutual friends?" When you click on a friend, you've got 300 or 400 mutual friends.
I'm ready to go.
You wouldn't have a great time. We could take you to all the best restaurants. There's one restaurant that has been there since my great-grandfather went down, I'm sure. It's the Napoli. And everyone, I don't care what zone, and you ask them their favorite restaurant, they'll tell you the Napoli.
It's a pizza, Italian restaurant.
Ready.
And he has the old, brick oven. Mm-hmm. I mean, still to this day, you go in, the same tables, everything is the same, and the pizza, the price is the same. It's from back, and when we used to be, going down there as a family, when we would go down, but it's just, and he still has his little, restaurant. Mm-hmm. Now it's kind of a spooky side of town now.
He opened up a new one.
Yeah,
which
he
is,
did. Yeah, better side, but he still has the old one. And one year I went down to work at the embassy for customs, TDY. That's just for a temporary duty assignment. And Karen came down with her brothers, and they were going to go to Napoli.
Let me paint the picture. Operation Just Cause, which is what went in and took Noriega out of country.
This is right after the 6th.
Kicked off in December 20th of 1989. Uh-huh. She's talking about June or July of 1990 that she was down there working. So there were still bomb holes, and I mean the remnants from the war were still very visible.
I went down to help put the office back together because the Marines had moved into the embassy, and all the U.S. Customs files had been transferred to Miami. Mm-hmm. So then they moved them back after the war, and they needed, you know, personnel down there to help put the office back together. Mm-hmm. So I was there for 45 days, and I told my family, you know, now's the time to come down to see Panama, to visit and everything. And I mean, there were still the military patrolling the canal zone, and but I wanted to tell this the night that you went to the Napoli. I just heard the story after. Go ahead.
We had just arrived, and so what we would typically do, we would get there and we would go straight to Napoli Pizza because that was where everybody wanted to go. Mm-hmm. But now the area where the original Napoli was in was in a very bad area. A lot of drugs, crack addicts, streetwalkers, just a really, the area had totally changed. Mm-hmm. And it had been bombed and everything else during the war. And so we still wanted to go there because the restaurant was still open and that's where we grew up going. So, you know, we just still felt like we can go there, you know, we can just don't wear your jewelry and stuff. So my sister-in-law, who my brother and her were not married yet, this was a trip he was going to propose to her on.
Right.
She had never been to Panama, had no idea. So we took her there. And she's mortified just by the nature of the area we're going into. We're like, oh, it's no big deal. It'll be fine. So we get into we park the car. There's a whole group of us. And we're going into the restaurant. All of a sudden, we hear gunfire. And so there's a local security guard out on the street corner. And we hear the gunfire and people running. And then there's people that are sitting on the outside tables of the restaurant. They just get under the table and they're literally grabbing the pizza off the table and eating it under the table. We go running inside the restaurant. My sister-in-law, Carson, is going, oh my God, what is this? Oh. You know, she's telling my brother, what did you bring me to? And so I take her and we go into the bathroom and I tell her, get on the toilet. Stand up on the toilet so nobody can see your feet. Because I immediately was thinking if the person comes in, then they won't see, you know, that they're just looking to shoot people. If we're on the toilet seat, they're not going to see anybody in the stall. So we're on the toilet seat standing there. And then I don't know where the men went or whatever. We just ran into the fuel bathroom. We just ran. And so
they
finally
were eating pizza, drinking
probably
beer.
Sitting in the restaurant eating. So finally we came out and there was no more gunfire. And it was a teenager, some young juvenile, robbing a taxi. So the security guard was shooting at him, but just shooting out in the open, like the Wild Wild West, you know. And so,
wow.
I tell you one thing about
that was very different from what growing up was like. Uh-huh. Right.
About being a Zonian, you have to experience something that really makes you a Zonian. And that's walking barefoot through the grass and stepping a fresh pile of dog dung. If you haven't done that, you haven't lived.
Well, the other thing is going on the black sand beaches, up in the beaches. Literally, you'd be walking and it'd be white sand, and all of a sudden you'd come upon black sand. And I can remember my friends and I, we literally one time, there were three of us, and we didn't have shoes, and it was so hot, it was burning our feet, and we tried to sit, but it was scalding us. And we saw a paper plate that was trash, and we grabbed the paper plate, and I was the tallest, so they climbed, my friends climbed on top of each other, then they got on my back, and then I stood on the paper plate, and then we would run a little bit, I'm holding them, stand on the paper plate, run a little bit, stand on the paper plate, until we could get to either the water, I don't remember if we went to the water or where we went to, but off the black sand, because it was going to burn, I mean, it was scalding us.
One of the things I just wanted to mention real quick, because I know our time is up, but living down there with disturbances in Panama City was a common thing. Mm-hmm. So you would hear, oh, they're rioting on Balboa Avenue. And that went right in front of the U.S. Embassy. Say, okay, well, we want to go shopping or we want to go see our friends, so we'll just stay off Balboa Avenue because, you know, they're rioting over there. And that's the way you lived your life when, you know, there were riots over whatever issues that the people in Panama felt. There was a lot of, there was an
instant, anti-American
stuff, yeah. One of my good friends lost an eye because he got caught in one of the, they were in a movie and came out and there were riots. But we lived our life off and on with things like that. So you never really, you took it seriously, you just stayed away, but it was a common occurrence, you know. I mean, common, I'd say probably once every 6 months they would riot over some issue.
But you know? that was mainly in the mid to late 50s, and that's where all the political influence came.
Right.
It was the politicians would fire the people up.
But even when I lived there as an adult, I was Christmas shopping on this one road that was called Avenida Central, and you could get stuff, you know, like jeans for $1. I mean, it was this place where you would get all these deals and Christmas shopping. And all of a sudden, this lady in a store goes, "You need to, you know," in Spanish, she was telling me to come in here, and she put me in a dressing room. And there was this group, this martyrs group that was marching. It was the anniversary of Just Cause. Mm-hmm. And they were doing a big demonstration coming down this main shopping area. And because I looked American, she was worried and concerned for me. And so she pulled me into her store and put me in the dressing room until they went on by.
One of our very close friends, Karen, we grew up together, their children, our children. Our friend Candy was shot and killed right in the invasion when they first went in. Mm-hmm. They were driving home late at night, and it was
from a Christmas party.
1 o'clock from a Christmas party, and two people stepped out of the bushes by Operc Air Force Base, and they shot at the car, and she was hit and died almost instantly. But and there were a lot of other Americans killed as well. During that time, it was a sad time for everyone, and Panamanians were killed as well.
And Karen's husband was one of the airborne troops that jumped in.
He was one of the first ones to jump in.
Just Cause, yeah.
Mm-hmm. He went to work one morning, didn't know, thought he was going to come home for dinner that night, but never came home for dinner that night, was on a plane going to Panama.
Well, thank you guys
stories.
So much for your time.
I wish we had a pleasure. Thank you for all your stories.